This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. And we're here three nights a week now, and we'd love to thank our listeners for their support for our new host, David Swanson, on Wednesdays and Charlie Giuliano on Monday nights. Tuesday and Wednesday is our airtime from 8 to 9 Eastern time. I'm sorry, that's Eastern time. I had all these new nights are mixing us up here. For those of you that are interested, you can call toll free and talk to our guest this evening at 877-489-6350 or toll free in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. The numbers again are 877-489-6350 or 888-228-4494. Tonight we have with us a really incredible and dynamic couple. They're dynamic and activists in the field of spirit in many different ways. Often people define activism as political, and yet to me that's such a limited use of the word. Another slight of common thinking is the usage of the words holistic and spirit. We conjure up images many times that have little to do with the actual work involved in these areas. No, not everybody is running around in a saffron robe shaving their heads off. I am pleased to share with our listeners a more concrete vision of what it is to do spiritual work or to work holistically in some less than traditional areas that people may not have often thought about, especially in the field of public relations, marketing, and publicity, such as Scott Tillett works in, and in facilitating healing in the fields of drugless health, with Andrea Ramirez, his wife, who deals in another facet of that. Welcome to our show, Scott and Andrea.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Thank you very
much. You're welcome. It's wonderful having you. You know, Scott, you have your show calls it an antidote collective, and it really speaks appropriately for the site that you have. The site, Scott's site, is www.antidotecollective.org. And it's a place where minds can come together and provide an antidote for the methods we use to do certain things in public relations. How can this kind of work, Scott, and what is the type of work that you do at Antidote Collective?
Well, I'm a communications and public relations consultant, largely. And the idea behind Antidote Collective was to bring people together that are sort of like-minded, like myself, that are from different communications disciplines, to use PR and communications to make a change in the world. I mean, there are people doing this besides me. There are a sort of growing, contingency of so-called progressive PR people out there. And, we promote, progressive ideas and causes and nonprofit organizations and things that we believe in to make a better change for the world, as opposed to, promoting, whatever products and services and contributing to the consumerism and the negative, messages and the destructive sort of things that exist in our society. I mean, that's basically it.
Let me ask you, Scott. You believe there's a great deal of cynicism in the consumer world today. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I mean, people are overwhelmed. You know, I think there's so many messages out there, bye, bye, bye. I mean, there's so many sort of spiritually numbing, you know, and I guess humanistically numbing messages out there. It's all about, you know, it's all about sort of buy this and you'll feel better, or, you know, do this and you know, this will make you whatever, this will make you whole. So, and there are a lot of sort of tactics out there that marketers use to get those messages across. So, naturally, there's cynicism. I mean, there's cynicism in the consumer culture, there's cynicism in politics, because the same thing exists in politics, and oftentimes politicians or, you know, campaign strategists use similar techniques that, you know, corporate marketers use. So, you know, I mean, people are sort of, they're cynical because they kind of see through it, and they're tired of it, and, you know, they see that this stuff doesn't make them healthier, better, you know, richer, whatever it is, richer in a spiritual sense, I guess.
Or in any kind of a sense, even in fulfilling the reasons why we consume.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we've become consumers as opposed to people, you know, and we're looked at as consumers. I grew tired of it, and I sort of, you know, as you probably saw in the bio on my site, I mean, I kind of broke through the corporate trance. You know, I used to do corporate stuff. I mean, nothing bad. I wasn't promoting cigarettes or, the defense industry or whatever. It certainly wasn't meaningful stuff. And I kind of saw through all of this stuff over, over a few years of my own spiritual transformation, and that's when I decided I couldn't do that stuff anymore, and I would apply what I learned in the corporate world, in the business world, and promoting ideas, products, and services, and apply it to stuff that could really have a positive effect on society. And, I guess, as you probably know, as an example, I've had a couple of my clients on your program.
Yes, you have. One of my favorites, as a matter of fact, Phil Donahue, we have had representatives of the Dalai Lama. Scott, for those of you who are listening, has been a publicist and marketing a lot of these wonderful people that are doing good works. And you're right, there is an element of cynicism. I know there is, you know, it's like, what's the trick anymore? And there's so much. We are being overwhelmed. I think probably decision making is a big part of this. And in the decision making process as a consumer, who do you trust? And how do you know who to trust? May I ask you, how are you implementing changes in that image of cynicism for the consumer today?
I don't know that I am on my level. The work that I do is perfectly fulfilling to me, and it's work that I see can have a positive effect. I mean, I don't know if it necessarily, you know, the work that I do can change cynicism about the work that I can do on a consumer level, because consumers don't necessarily see the work that I do behind the scenes, if that makes any sense. But certainly I think the clients and the projects and the organizations that I do work with, you know, are having a positive effect. You know, you mentioned Phil Donahue, which I worked on his anti-war film, Body of War, and that's why he was on your program, and you interviewed him about Body of War. I mean, you know, everyone knows Phil, and he's passionate about, you know, his very liberal views, and he did this film where he sort of went into the life of this returning Iraqi vet who was paralyzed after 5 days of serving in Iraq. And he follows, you know, this guy's life. He's a young kid, 20-something. He went to Iraq because he really had no future, and he wasn't doing anything in Kansas City, Missouri, and he saw George W. Bush give the speech after 9/11 and let's go get the evildoers, and he got all sort of patriotic and worked up and said, yeah, I want to serve my country, and he went, and then he got disillusioned because he wasn't going after the evildoers. He was in Afghanistan, you know, he went to Iraq, and he came back and he became an anti-war activist. And you know, in film he documents this, and there's on so many levels, go ahead, sorry.
You know, can I ask you what role you played in marketing this production of Phil's? Which was fascinating. For those of you that have never seen it, Body of War is an excellent documentary. I highly recommend it to everyone.
Yeah, well, I did some grassroots outreach and, you know, trying to get peace and social justice groups and democratic clubs across the country and veterans groups, to get them excited about the film and promote it to their members and to just try to get people to go see the film, because these kinds of films and these kinds of issues are hard, you know, and when you have Hollywood budgets, you know, films for Hollywood blockbusters and competing for, people's dollars, I guess, movie ticket dollars, it's hard. So, you know, we reached out to people to try to spread buzz about the film, and then I also did, some media and tried to get interviews for Phil, as I did on your show, to talk about the film and tried to get, you know, people to review the film and basically just get the word out so people could go see it and see the message of the film. And that's what I do in the different projects that I do.
What are some of the antidotes that you use, and why did you pick the term antidote? It's almost like a cure for some wild disease or something.
Well, that's kind of it. The malaise that exists in our society, all of this stuff that, you know, we've been talking about, is sort of corporate malfeasance and the cynical consumerism and all this stuff. So the name antidote came as I'm trying to offer something to cure that, and that's basically it.
Can I ask you? I know that you do a lot of training and educating in some of the major corporations and companies. How do you educate or train or guide companies in fulfilling the mission of spirit in a business as opposed to just plain old selling?
Oh, I don't, actually.
Okay. Well, then we'll just talk that one.
Yeah, I mean, you may be confusing me with one of my clients that was on your program, David Mishy. He wrote a book, Buddhism for Busy People.
Uh-huh.
And he gives, he gives workshops on sort of meditation and incorporating sort of Buddhist ideals. And he gives them, you know, he has a background and actually has a PR firm in Australia. So he does stuff like that. But that's another kind of message. You know, when I promoted his book, I promoted it not just to the sort of people who are interested in Buddhism and spirituality and New Age issues, but I promoted it to the corporate world as well, and actually got a pretty decent response. I think, because there's a growing sort of consciousness within the business community as well that, you know, things aren't sustainable as they are, and people are unhappy and they're looking for something deeper. And you know, people like David Mishy and you know, there are other people doing this, give workshops on spirituality and how to integrate that into, you know, your professional life or even your organization. And that's something on a personal level that obviously Andrea and I have done. I mean, we've been talking about how I've integrated it and, you know, I changed the direction of my career from corporate stuff to this kind of stuff because of our spiritual path. And Andrea incorporates this into her practice on a personal level and also with her clients.
Well, I want to talk to Andrea deeply. There's one question, though, I would like to ask the both of you. Did your spiritual path lead you in this direction, or were you in these fields prior and it took on an overtone of spirituality?
I'll start with mine. I mean, I sort of was on a spiritual path. You know, I got pretty intensively into yoga in the late 90s, like around 98 or 99 or so, and doing some other sort of consciousness exploration stuff, and that started opening my mind and you know, opening, as I said before, I sort of broke the, you know, corporate trance, and that was a part of it, certainly. And then 9/11 happened, and you know, I was laid off actually from my corporate job just before 9/11 because the economy sort of tanked, and I was in the dot-com world, kind of. And 9/11 was a huge spiritual thing for obviously everyone, a lot of people, and for me as well. And I think from that moment on is when I started looking for something deeper, and then I started a meditation practice that, as it turned out, Andrea and I both do, although we came to it separately, in 2004. And right after my first 10-day meditation retreat is when I started Antidote Collective, although I was already heading in that direction of doing for the progressive, you know, public interest-oriented PR and communications, but I started Antidote Collective proper just after my first 10-day course.
Wonderful. Andrea has a really wonderful and refreshing take on healing. It's a method she calls bioindividuality. But before we stray too far from that subject, I wanted to ask you that same question, Andrea. Did this information or this field come to you prior to your spiritual path or as a result of?
My spiritual path, for me, is very difficult to think of my spiritual path as such. I really, my life and my work and everything I do is integrated in such a way that it's really hard for me to kind of separate what is spiritual and what is not. I can tell you that I grew up being an extremely intuitive child, and my first career was as a musician in Colombia. This is what I used to do for a living before I came to this country, and things just kind of brought me where I am now. And I was always a seeker, and I even though not consciously, yes, intuitively, I was just looking for something that would be fulfilling and that would be of service, and so I tried many things and read and explored, and finally came to what I do nowadays, which is both fulfilling, extremely fulfilling personally, and it is an extremely spiritual thing as well. But again, it's not like there was a separation. As Scott said, we both have the same meditation practice that we both came to do separately. And when we met, we realized we were doing it. And that, I feel that my meditation practice, even though it's still pretty incipient, always was kind of in the background since I started professionally to be a health counselor. It was kind of always in the background, in the sense of just a sense of feeling that I'm doing something that is very honest, that is very helpful, and that is very authentic and sincere, that I can talk about with all passion and at the same time just have profound faith that it's helping whoever wants to listen.
You know, you have a there's a word that you use, bioindividuality.
Yes.
I absolutely love it. First of all, I think that personifies what most healers do in the holistic field, is we work with the individual. And for you to take this to a nutritional level, I think is profound. Can you explain to us about bioindividuality and what your concept, why it's different from traditional nutritional counseling?
I always tell my clients and potential clients that I want them to think of these. The first thing that I like for people to be very clear about is that I am not a nutritionist, and I don't have any desire or interest in being, because traditional nutrition doesn't take in account the individual as such. Every major nutrition tradition does, however, like Ayurveda or Chinese medicine, always starts from the individual. And when we think about individuality, I always tell people, think about it as you are going to, we don't want to accommodate you into a diet book and follow what somebody else said about the way that you should eat. Let's think of this as we are going to write your own diet book, which is our way of eating book. The word diet has so many connotations. Some are them positive, some of them negative, but your book is about your own way of eating. And why? Because diet is unique, as everything else in life for a specific person is unique, and is also dynamic. It changes all the time. This is one really huge missing piece that is hard to understand for people when they find a way of eating that they still work for them, and later on in life, that same way of eating doesn't work anymore, because we change, and diet should change in the same way. Just like cows know that they should eat grass, if they're left to eat grass, obviously, we know what we should eat deep inside, underneath all the layers of information, and more than anything, misinformation around nutrition that we have. We know what we should eat.
You call many of the foods, Andrea, primary foods.
Yes.
Can you talk to us a little bit about primary foods and what you mean by that? And
yes.
What is a primary food?
So this concept I learned in my alma mater, which is the Institute for Integrative Nutrition in New York City. And it's really a revolutionary concept in the field of nutrition. Primary food, as opposed to secondary food. So secondary food is all the food that we put in our mouth, everything that we eat, and this includes vices as well, like alcohol or sugar, which is the most common one of all, or drinking. Now, primary food is everything that we get nourished from, but we don't eat. So anything that has to do with your career, relationships, spirituality, or physical activity is part of your primary food. Now, the link between physical activity and nutrition, for example, has been established already for a few decades. And just now, people in, let's say, traditional medicine and traditional nutrition is coming to update themselves in the fact that not only physical activity, but these other areas, spirituality, career, relationships, are also part, have a direct relation and effect on the way that we eat. So whenever there is an imbalance in any of the areas of your primary food, you will always try to control them in some way with your secondary food. Why? Because food is something that we feel we can control. And most of the time is controlling us, but we feel we can control it. And this is very, very clear in, for example, a sugar addiction. It's usually very emotional. It's got to do with our level of stress. having a really busy lifestyle that doesn't give time to be, but just do. And we end up in such a stressed body that we either exercise too much or become addicts to sugar. So that's the concept of primary food and secondary food.
So you're saying that if the primary food, is actual food considered primary foods if it is whole nutritional?
We like to think of primary food of actual food in the sense that we get nourished from it. We get nourished from our daily work.
Right, that's what I'm asking. Is there actually a point, a part of the, so primary foods are any action or event that actually nourishes the body, including physical exercise, meditation, those forms of things that can help de-stress a body. That becomes a food because it nourishes the body. Nurtures the body. But does food become a primary food as well, or is that always a secondary food?
Food is the secondary food. Think of a child that it's completely immersed, and I put the example of a child because it's always easier for a child, but a child that is completely immersed and in the flow of what he's doing, like, for example, playing with his friends, and how mom has to come out and pretty much just pull him out of there to, you know, make him have a couple of bites before, because when he's out there and in the flow and having his primary food fulfilled, secondary food becomes secondary. There is no need for it.
Wow.
An artist that is completely in the flow of his painting doesn't
Absolutely a beautiful concept. I really, really appreciate that. We're going to take a break right now, and we will return with Andrea Ramirez and Scott Tillett for more questions. We've already got some questions from our listeners for both of you, so we're going to take a short break right now, and we'll be right back.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime, to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
Got questions? The library has got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on Earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
This land is yours.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio Show. You can call in at 877-489-6350 or 888-228-4494 and speak to our guests live. We have with us tonight PR consultant and writer of Antidote Collective, Scott Tillett, and his lovely wife, Andrea Ramirez, holistic health counselor of Soul Terra Holistic. You can go and find out more about this incredible nutritional experience at soulterraholistic.com. Those sites are on our website. You can go there and get it, and you'll also be able to get more information on these incredible ways of dealing with life. And I think that's really what it boils down to. How do we deal with life, and are there more effective techniques? And I believe that both of you have come across some incredible techniques. We have a question from one of our audience members, Janice in Wisconsin. This is for Scott. Does Scott deal directly with the Dalai Lama in India, or his office is here in the USA, and is he a Buddhist, or does he just practice meditation?
I haven't dealt directly with the Dalai Lama in India, no. I wish I could say I had a direct line to him, but no. A couple of times I've worked with him. Once was a visit that he did to Shambhala Mountain Center in Colorado, and so I worked with Shambhala Mountain Center. They were my client, so to speak. And then the first time, which was really my first project in getting into this new, you know, line of work, the new direction of my career, was his visit to New York in 2003. And in that case, it was Richard Gere's foundation that hired my colleague and myself. Am I a Buddhist? No, I mean, I wouldn't categorize myself as anything, because I find that can be limiting, but the type of meditation I do is the meditation technique that the Buddha himself, you know, became enlightened with and taught, and it's been handed down, you know, through the generations and maintained in its purity, and that's the technique I learned and practice. I have promoted a couple of Buddhist books from different traditions. I certainly resonate with Buddhist thought and Buddhist philosophy, but no, I don't limit myself by calling myself a Buddhist.
You know, Andrea, as a healer myself, I often explain that the physical manifestations are the last stages of illness. And since our spirits and our energy fields do not eat organic food, what are some of the things that that make our spirits sick, and how do primary foods feed that soul in other ways?
That's a really good question. I actually just wrote a newsletter that is very relevant to this. Yes, definitely. Illness is kind of the last show of what is going wrong. And not only we can be very pragmatic and not only talk about along the lines of the spirit, but just lifestyle in general. We could talk about it with more of a spiritual approach, but it's just the simple things like not having half an hour in the morning to sit down and eat a conscious breakfast, the idea of using a pill to fix everything, with not having to be in my body, feel what I'm feeling, feel if I have a cold, respect my body and let my body clean, which cleans the body from excess that needs to get out, and we don't even respect that we want to take something to fix it right away. So we're just violating ourselves in so many ways that eventually the body just kind of you know, breaks down in some way.
It does. It becomes very dense and very, very filled with toxins. You know, I know that you and Scott are very into meditation. That you recently have fed your primary food needs by meditating in the mountains. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, we actually just yesterday got back from a 10-day silent meditation retreat, and our tradition is called Vipassana. This is, you know, what I was talking about before, that it was handed down. It's the technique that the Buddha himself became enlightened with, supposedly, and, you know, it's been passed down through the generations. And we go to this center in Western Massachusetts, and there are a few traditions of Vipassana around the world. The one that we practice is taught by S.N. Goenka, who was an Indian businessman who grew up in Burma, and that's where the tradition was sort of maintained in its purity, and then he started teaching it and started centers around the world, and Andrea's been 3 or 4 times over the last 4 or 5 years. I've been probably, you know, a dozen or so. And so we were just there for a 10-day retreat. It's complete silence, and you sit and meditate for 9 to 10 hours a day. It's really, really intense. It's, you know, the teacher calls it deep surgery on the mind, and it really is. It is surgery. You're opening up the mind and clearing it out. I mean, you're sort of looking at things as they are, and you know, trying to remain equanimous to whatever comes up in the moment as you are observing your mind and the sensations in your body, which are sort of manifestations of what your mind is reacting to. And you're basically training yourself to be equanimous, and you carry that over into everyday life, it's just such a purifying process. And
I like the term a quantumist. I really like that term.
Quantumist?
I like the term quantumist. That's very interesting.
It is a funny. The first time I really heard it, I laughed. You know, our teacher, he's Indian, so he speaks English very well, but he obviously, because English is not his first language, he uses some funny words, and quantumist is one of those words. You don't hear it, you know, very often, but it is such a great word, and it's so, the meaning of the word the meaning of the word is so powerful. I mean, when you can become equanimous to what happens day to day, you know, driving in traffic and someone cuts you off and you don't get upset by that, that's a beautiful thing. I mean, it works on so many levels, you know, just remaining equanimous to everything. So, yeah, it's a beautiful word.
Well, very nice. You know, we have some more questions. Sylvia from New York wants to ask Andrea, does she have any recommendations on healthy fast food restaurants when you simply don't have time to cook or make your own meals while away from home? Is there such a thing,
yes,
Andrea?
Oh, my goodness. Off the top of my head, in New York City, I couldn't say. I always like to tell people in such circumstances to carry snacks with them. I love health food stores, obviously, and most health food stores will have easy things that you can carry with you. Salads, obviously, are usually the best choice. And also, we always have to remember that restaurants have always more vegetables that they put in the menu, and if there is something that it's in a menu, you can always ask, instead of, you know, to have a vegetable, there will be at least broccoli or spinach or something like that that you can have with it. Now, the idea of the fast food is really goes down to what the question of this person is. When we have a busy life, so my work as a holistic health counselor is really getting to the root of exploring what that means and why is that. It's always so funny when I talk to my clients or potential clients, and they tell me, I really like being busy, and I'm busy, 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 and I have no time to do things that I want to do. So I always try to explore that very closely. Like, so you're telling me that you really love being very busy, but at the same time you don't have time to do things that you think are very important. So it's a great contradiction, and it really starts exploring how we are prioritizing our life. And unfortunately, I'm not talking to this person directly, but if I was, I would definitely try to get to the root of what priorities are and what being busy means, and why is this person sacrificing health? Because as I see it, without a healthy, sound body to go around doing busy things, there is really not a meaning on being so busy. Busy for what?
I love that you focus more on why are you so busy than recommending a particular fast food restaurant.
The idea of the fast food restaurant is the same idea of having a pill that would fix everything. You know, like, I'm just going to take this pill, and I'm not going to have this headache. I'm just going to take this pill, and It's always giving, we kind of always are always handling our responsibility to others as opposed to carrying responsibility for our own health.
Even in the fast food decision, the fact that you go to a fast food restaurant because you don't have time is the first infraction against your primary food. The primary food was, why are you so busy? This is causing a lot of stress in your life. How do you address that primary food, and then worry about the salad that you're going to pick?
Yes, and someone can tell me, oh, you don't know, you know, like, my lifestyle is just like this. The way that I work is like this, like that. So then again, I just go back to the root of, you know, what are your priorities? Do you want to be really happy? We have a lot of misconceptions about how to be happy or to be successful or to have the money that we want to have. We need to sacrifice our body, and that is a misconception that advertisement is very good at selling to us every day.
And that's where Scott comes in. He's supposed to change this.
This is exactly what Antidote Collective is about, an antidote to that kind of false advertising that exists out there.
So I always like to think, Scott and I feel blessed, and I'm grateful every day, but at the same time, I know that we have both made a conscious decision to live a life that is honest and truthful, even in the sense of always having time for things that are important and keeping our bodies healthy. I will usually make lunch for us, and we will usually have time to take a hike or do things that we know fulfill our spirit, our meditation, for example. And we keep that as a priority, and we are successful professionals as well, and we are making a very nice lifestyle, fulfilling all these things. So as opposed to this paradigm that we encounter every day, I am convinced that the more that we're close to our own purpose and to the real things that are important to us, the more prosperous in every sense our life is. We're more healthy, and we have the needs that we have. We fulfill all our needs the closer that we get to what we really want to do. But we're always, every day, we're being sold on the idea of, no, you need to sacrifice, because this is the way. Around these fears is where, you know, all the advertisement and the food industry, the food processing industry, and the pharmaceutical industry work.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. And again, many times I think that we're so busy now that we are losing the concept of success. And in order to, if we slowed down, we'd be more successful. It's kind of a paradox. You know, Richard from Oklahoma asked a question that Andrea has already answered, but maybe you can recap briefly for Richard, because we don't want him to think that we forgot about him. His question is, where is Andrea from, and did she learn about healing and nutrition from her native culture?
I am originally from Colombia, and I love that question because not clearly or directly. I learned it because I grew up on a very simple household. My mom was a single mother with two kids, but somehow she always had time to feed us really good homemade meals. And she also has a very strong sense of intuition around everything and around sickness, and she always respected illness for what it is and tried to, she was the typical mother of, you know, you need a nice chicken soup to get strong, you know, as opposed to let's run to the doctor so you get an antibiotic because we need to go. So I learned from her that it was important to have homemade meals and simple food and respect the body. So I carry this, I call it common sense because to me it really is common sense. I carry this with me, and when I came to this country and my body started to become unbalanced, I look back into that knowledge that I grew up with and started exploring it.
Well, that's I absolutely know exactly what you mean, because I come from a Palestinian Arab home, and we have the traditional Mediterranean diet that is I don't even know where we'd be without that. I really would have been messed up. You know, we have a wonderful question here that I think is very, very powerful and very important for many people that don't understand how prosperity works. Jack in Florida asked, does Scott feel that the West has contaminated spiritual movements and persons such as Deepak Chopra or His Holiness the Dalai Lama? There are always criticisms of great wealth accumulated by leaders in spiritual movements.
Well, the Dalai Lama cannot be considered wealthy, I don't think.
By any stretch of the imagination.
Right. At least not in a material sense. Deepak Chopra certainly is. And the question is, has that wealth contaminated, I guess, spirituality, or sort of, I guess, maybe the perception of spirituality?
I think a lot of people feel that somehow the two are not synonymous. You know, to be able
right.
to have great wealth and to be spiritual somehow does not, never the twain shall meet.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I mean, I certainly there have been some cases of, you know, some sort of fake spiritual leaders who have just used spirituality much as, you know, some people use religion to start wars. I mean, they fused spirituality and preyed on people's weaknesses and insecurities for their own personal material gain. I don't think that they are mutually exclusive. I mean, I think you can be prosperous spiritually, and the material prosperity can come. And I don't mean that in a the secret kind of sense of, you know, you sort of think of the red bike and you're going to get a red bike, and, you know, you think sort of spiritually of a red bike or whatever. I don't mean it in that sense, but I mean you just leave yourself open and your needs will sort of be fulfilled. And if you have certain material needs, I think that will come to you. You know, as long as you sort of, as Andrea said earlier, if you're living your purpose, you know, certainly material things can come from that. And I don't, you know, you don't have to be a wandering ascetic monk. You know, you certainly, I mean, the Buddha himself, you know, spoke of the middle path, and I think you can walk the middle path and and be materially comfortable, and at the same time have this sort of strong spiritual practice. So,
well, I know that people within the spiritual movement, if that's what we want to choose to call it today, such as myself, have had issues with that originally when I first started. And when you are offering a service such as energy work or that type of thing, there is an ethical base to it. And as I said, the conception for most people is that you cannot have both. You can't be spiritual and be prosperous. But prosperity is a very wide, and if you're offering a service and it is accepted, you are actually creating prosperity in another when you're offering these services. And so for me, that is just a beautiful thing. Why would I choose to cut off someone else's prosperity by cutting off my own prosperity? Because that feeling, that mindset will translate into energy work. It'll translate into everything that I do. And it actually taints it, I believe, and hinders the prosperity process.
I always think of this misconception that money is dirty, or people that have money do bad things. And I always like to remember of how, first of all, money doesn't really have a moral value. Money is just as dirty or as clean as the person that has it. And think of all the beautiful things that can be done when there is money. I'm not talking about, you know, the typical, you know, going to the beach and, you know, whatever, buying jewelry or whatever. But think of all the change that someone with money and a good understanding of prosperity and spirituality can do. It definitely facilitates a lot if there is money.
Yeah, I mean, think of philanthropy. I mean, you know, many people who have tons of money and have a spiritual practice and have a sort of ethical, you know, view on life and a moral view on life, donate, you know, money for good causes. I mean, sometimes it's to feed the ego. They want their name attached to it, but that's not always the case. You know, you can feed the poor, for example, you know, whatever it is. I mean, and if you have a sort of a strong moral foundation, then that money can be used for good things. You know, you take care of yourself and those who depend upon you, and then any extra you can give to, certainly to, you know, to help others.
Well, the point being that the monetary system isn't the evil that we would like, although many parts of it have been used for dark things. It isn't really meant to be that way, or it doesn't have to be that way. You know, we've got a really great question here from Alice in California, and get ready, Scott and Andrea, the lovebirds. Alice in California asked, Scott and Andrea sound like a very nice couple. How did they meet, and was their spirituality one of those points of connection?
How did we meet? Well, we met... It's not very spiritual how we met. We met at a party in Berlin.
We're testing you, Scott.
What's that?
We're testing you.
we met through a mutual friend at a party in Brooklyn, and in a sense, our spirituality was a common, was a point of connection, because as we talked during that first night, you know, I discovered that she was at the Institute for Integrative Nutrition and into holistic health, and I had been to Dr. Weil, Andrew Weil, you know, for years, and I brought that up, and, you know, it turned out that he had taught at the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, so she was obviously familiar with his work. I had an interest in this, and then somehow Vipassana came up, and we discovered we both had done it before. So yeah, I guess in a sense it certainly was a point of connection, but it, you know, wasn't through any kind of, I don't know, maybe fate brought us together, you know, if you want to look deeper into it, but it was a party.
I do believe that faith brought us together, definitely, because for me, going to this party where I met Scott, it was like the most random thing that I would ever do. This common friend that Scott's talking about wasn't really a friend of mine, was his friend that I had talked to like 5 minutes somewhere the week before, and he just called me out of nowhere and invited me to this party because it was close to my house. He called me and he said, oh, remember we met last Saturday, we talked for like 5 minutes, and I remember that you live in this neighborhood and I'm in a party, and why don't you come? And I would never go to a place where I basically don't know anyone, but for some reason, I believe to meet Scott, I just said yes, and I got there, and this common friend, who was really not my friend up to that point, just introduced me to Scott, and we just basically talked for the rest of the night. And that was all I did in there.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, we could go on and on. You are a very delightful couple, and that's why I left that one question till the end. The show is wrapping up right now. It's been a pleasure having you, Scott and Andrea, with us. We hope to have you soon, and keep up the great work, both of you. These are fascinating lines of work that you're in, and it's just, you know, we need more people like you in the world. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We need more radio shows like yours.
We're working it. Well, as I said, folks, we're here three nights a week now. Our upcoming guests are Karen Kitwowski, a 911 Pentagon survivor, David Ray Griffin, 911 Truth Movement, and a few other shows are coming up. So please come with us. Join us at Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday night at the People Speak Radio. Thank you all very much, and have a great evening.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.